most of us distract mm-hmm. ourselves from our pain. We don't want to feel it. We feel shame about it. We numb it. We avoid it. We work it away. We fuck it away. We smoke it away. Like we don't want to deal with it. And so I think healing is just simply that, allowing yourself to sit and be with and feel and express.
Born in 92 on the block with the sharks, cut from a different cloth, y'all would get ripped apart. You want a diamond, then you gotta get it in the dark. We dropping nuggets like Carmelo went to Rucker Park. Now we eating from state to state, we scrape the plate. I put my eggs in a basket, took a leap of faith. I took a chance, now we grow and see the impact. Decoding success with special guests, now let's bring Matt.
Welcome to the Decoding Success Podcast, episode number 313, as we are joined by my friend David Sutcliffe for a conversation around how to master our emotions, past, present, and future emotions, to master our reality, our today, this present moment, and beyond. It's your host, Matt Labrie, and I am here to say welcome. Excited to have you back, and if it is your first time joining the show, oh man, let me tell you, you are in for a treat. Now, many know David for his roles as an actor. Maybe you've even seen him on Gilmore Girls, but today, David is a somatic practitioner, certified in core energetics, and David has been coaching, leading groups, workshops, and training since 2011, and today he is here on Decoding Success to lead us, to coach us, to guide us to mastering our emotions, to master our reality. Now, as David joins us here, we're going to be exploring a few areas around mastering our emotions, letting go of our past, cutting the cord with things that have happened and that we're carrying in to this present moment, and so much more. And I want to share a couple of my takeaways, and I just got to let you know, it is so hard to pull 3 takeaways and share them with you at the top of this episode. Now, of course, I could talk for days, but I don't want to hold out on the good stuff. So I'm going to give you 3 really quickly. Number 1, at the end of this episode, this is something you're going to want to stay around for. It's at the wee end of the episode. David emphasizes the importance of playing hard in life, but not taking life too seriously. He expands upon this. He uses some great references like Larry Bird and Wayne Gretzky and even Michael Jordan. So you're going to want to hear the importance of playing hard in life, but why we should not take life so seriously. Number 2, I asked David an important question, many actually during this episode, but one in particular, and I'm sure many of you have this question as well. The question is, can you heal at the scene of the crime? In other words, can you heal where your trauma has taken place? And when I say where, that might mean in the presence of the individual that may have caused said trauma, because trauma does happen in relationships. And David's response to this is an answer you are going to want to hear. Lastly, number 3, while there's so many more points to talk about, I'm going to give you just 3, like I mentioned. We're going to just dive into where the most trauma takes place. And not just where the most trauma takes place, but where does the most healing take place? That is within this episode as well. On that note, it is time for me to put it on your heart and on your mind to make sure that you are sharing this episode. You're here for a reason. You're hearing this for a reason. There is someone you know that also needs to be aware of this episode, aware of this podcast. So on that note, share this. Screenshot this episode, throw it up on your Instagram story, tag David and myself so that we could show you love back. Again, you're here for a reason, and there's someone in your life, being that I'm placing this on your heart and your mind, there is someone in your life that also needs to hear that. But on that note, I'm not going to hold out on you getting to the good stuff any longer. Without further ado, we bring to you David Sutcliffe.
David.
How are you, man?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good.
I love to hear it. I love to hear it. You beat me to my first question. I'm always asking my guests how they are, because in my early days of podcasts, and I would just like jump right into it, and it's like, it's a bit startling. So I'm curious, how are you? How are you really?
I am. I don't want to say I'm busy, because I think it's bad to say you're busy, but I'm full with work, and but work that I'm enjoying and feel inspired by. So that's good, but there's a lot of it to do, and I'm absorbed in it, which is a good feeling actually, when you're absorbed in work that you love. So, yeah, life is good.
I love to hear that. Why is it bad to say that we're busy?
I don't know. I think it's like busy. You know, I always hear people saying that busy is a way to distract yourself. Like, I'm busy with all these tasks.
Yeah.
And I think there's an energy to busy that, I don't know, that word, it implies something. And like, I don't have time to rest, or I don't have time to do things that I love, or I'm distracted slightly. And so I'm trying to get away from using that word. I don't know. Maybe it's not a big deal. I'm just being very vigilant with my language recently. Like, I just heard, I heard Patrick Bet-David say this, and then I just heard, what's his name? Solbra?
Some I'm not guy. Familiar. Okay.
Yeah, Solbra, I think his name is. He's some Australian guy. He's got a big Instagram following. That both of them were like, never say you're tired.
Interesting.
I'm tired, because you're reinforcing the idea that you're tired. So you got to tell yourself that you have an unlimited energy.
That and listen, I do agree with you in regards to, like, when I tell myself I'm busy, I do feel like there's like a bit of tension with that word, you know, like a little bit of a tight chest feeling, or you know, whatever might be coming about with busy. I'm curious to learn how you, and by the way, I hope you don't mind, I'm already recording, like, we go just
yeah
right out of the gate. You were saying that you were being like vigilant with your language and your vocabulary. What's the practice of doing that? How do you implement that?
Well, I think the first thing is you have to be aware.
Yeah.
Aware of the words you're using, the language you're using. So much of it is unconscious, or it's habitual.
Mm-hmm.
And often we're reinforcing thoughts and beliefs and ideas that are not useful for us. So yeah, something like busy, you say, it creates some kind of tension.
Yeah.
But when you say, oh, you know, my schedule is full with work that I love, it creates a different feeling inside us. And it's the same with tired. I don't want to reinforce the idea that I'm tired. Maybe I need some rest. Maybe I need to take a nap.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to re-energize, but words have power, you know. The unconscious, hears them in a particular kind of way. The unconscious doesn't hear language in context.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always in some way programming ourselves through our thoughts and through the language that we use. And so I'm trying to get really mindful of not just the language that I'm using, but also my thoughts, my habitual thought patterns, but also the things that I'm consuming. You know, if I'm getting on Twitter and I'm reading about how everything is falling apart and the world's a disaster, that fills me with fear. And anxiety. So is that helpful for me? Maybe it's okay. I know what's going on. Maybe I can take 5 or 10 minutes, but do I really want to be absorbing this energy of fear and anxiety? I don't think it's helpful.
Does it matter if we believe the words we're sharing? So for example, I would love to make the change from saying, my schedule is very busy today, to it's full with work that I enjoy. I do enjoy the work that I do. I love podcasting. I love consulting the way that I consult. But my question instantly is, do we have to believe those words for them to impact us?
That's a good question. I think the unconscious is very permeable. So, I think the unconscious believes it, whether we believe it or not, I think.
Oh, okay.
Is what happens. Yeah.
Okay.
We're very, human beings are very, very suggestible.
Mm.
And, especially when we're in an unconscious state, when we're not really fully present, which most of us are a lot of the time, like when we're consuming media, for instance, right? We're scrolling through it. We're really in a kind of hypnotic state. If you look at somebody scrolling on their phone, they're, you know, they're almost hypnotized in some way.
That's
so it's, all of it is really just a practice. And so I can be reading. Well, there's all these studies on hypnosis, just like the environment that you surround yourself with. There's a guy that I saw on, YouTube. He's a mentalist. I forget his name. Very famous British guy.
Is it Oz Perlman or something like that?
No, I forget. He's got a Netflix special. He's incredible. But
Keith Barry.
No, not Keith Barry. No? It's another guy. He was on Rogan, and He does conversational hypnosis, and there's a bit that he does with an actor, and he has, I forget the actor, I forget everybody's name. I'm getting old. I can't remember anybody's name, but he asked the guy to it previously. We don't see this part. He's like, I want you to write down what you want for your birthday. Write it down in a slip of paper, put it in your wallet. And the guy does that. And then he walks into this room and he starts having a conversation with this, this mentalist, this hypnotist. And the room is, it's a set, and there's kind of interesting pictures on the wall. It's all very abstract. And by the end of their conversation, which is like about 4 minutes, he asks the guy, what was it that you, you wanted for your birthday? And the guy says, I wanted a red BMX bike, which is an odd thing for a man to say. I want a red BMX bike. It's like a child's thing. And there's a big box behind him. And he says, okay, open the box. And he opens a box, and inside there's a red BMX bike. And the guy, of course, is confounded. He's just like, oh my God, how did you do that? How did you know? He's like, ah. And then he said, is that what you wrote down, you know, on the slip of paper that's in your wallet? And he's like, yeah, I wrote a red BMX bike. He's like, well, pull it out. And he pulls it out, and written on the slip of paper was a leather jacket. And so this guy was freaked out. I was freaked out watching it. And then he showed afterwards how he did it, it with the really subtle language tricks and also the things that were on the wall, convinced him in real time that what he actually wanted was a BMX bike. So when you think about that, and you think about the media, and you think about what they're doing, and you go on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and you realize like how impressionable we are, how subject we are to persuasion and hypnosis. We believe that we think our thoughts independently, but in fact, most of our opinions have been programmed. They've been assigned to us in some way. And so if you really want to get free in your mind, you have to be incredibly disciplined about what it is you are consuming, what it is you're choosing to look at. Otherwise, I don't care how smart you think you are, you're going to be programmed in some way. And so I've been really focused on all of that lately, and what it is that I'm consuming. But as I said, like the language I'm using, how I'm speaking, the way I'm framing things, like is how I'm thinking about this thing or talking about this thing, does it make me feel more powerful, or is it diminishing my power? And I want to do everything I can to make myself as powerful and free as possible.
Couple of things. Number one, you gave me a wicked deja vu. This is the first time we're meeting face to face.
Oh, really?
You were, I literally was sitting here and I'm like, holy fuck, I've been here before. You ever get those?
That's funny. Yeah. I don't know what that is. I know there's theories about it.
Yeah. Like what's your glitch thought about Matrix? That?
I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, apparently there is a physiological reason for it. But I actually don't know offhand. But
that is,
but maybe not. Maybe there's something else.
Yeah.
Oh, here it is. Yeah, Darren Brown explains hypnosis. Yeah, Simon Pegg. That's what it is. So for your audience, go to YouTube and Google Simon Pegg with Darren Brown, and you will find this clip, and it will blow your mind.
I want to check that out right after this. But you know, one thing I've been trying to believe about deja vu, an old coworker said this to me. He was like, dude, that just means you're in the right place. You know, right place, right time. You know, like your life's on track. Like if you're getting that glitch of the Matrix, like you know, this is right. Where you're supposed to be. That's your reassurance.
Well, here it is. If you believe that, then it's true, right?
Yeah.
Like you make it so. Like if you choose to believe that, then it is true. And what is the feeling that gives you? It gives you a good feeling. It tells you that you're on the right track. It tells you exactly where you're supposed to be. So that, I think that's how reality works. I think it's like reality is neutral. It just exists. And it just is, so to speak. And our thoughts and beliefs, we impose it on reality. And that is what literally creates our reality. And the example that I always use, it's like, if you're going to a party and you have a belief that everybody at this party is going to be stuck up and pretentious, well, you're going to show up to that party in a kind of defensive posture, mm-hmm. right? And what is that going to do? People are going to experience you as defended, and they're not going to be open to you, of course, yeah. because you're not open. So which confirms the belief that you have, literally creating your reality. Conversely, if you go into a party thinking everybody's going to be warm and friendly, I can't wait to meet people, I'm excited, and you come in with that open energy, well, people are going to respond in kind to that, and you're going to have an experience of people being warm and friendly. So I think we're creating our reality in every moment. I think most of us have a lot of unconscious programming from childhood, you know, belief systems that we have. Mm-hmm. And that's really the core of the work that I do. It's helping people understand the things that happened to them in their childhood, which are not always easy to come to terms with, because some of it was very painful and scary, and understanding how that is impacting them as an adult today, and how they're often playing out some of the things that happened in their childhood in their adult lives.
Yeah, for sure. I would definitely want to get into that childhood stuff in a minute. I want to go back to what you were saying about, like, you know, scrolling Twitter and how media hypnotizes us and stuff. I'm curious to know if you believe that is it possible to be impenetrable?
No.
No. Okay.
No. I don't see any evidence of that.
Okay.
I think we're all very persuadable. I think we like to tell ourselves another story. Mm-hmm. But I think it's almost like because you're not present in every moment, you're not evaluating every single thing mm-hmm. that is coming into your field. And so, you know, I think things impact us in unconscious ways. Mm-hmm. And so I think the only remedy is to set up your environment such that you are mitigating against any kind of negative programming. I mean, that's, you know, feng shui. There's all kinds of theories about that. And there's a lot of people, I mean, I hear Mike Cernovich talking about this on Twitter, that he doesn't listen to music with words because those words are programming him. And so much music is about heartbreak and loss and disappointment. And Scott Adams, the same. And, you know, these are both people who've done intense studies on persuasion. In Scott Adams' case, he is a trained hypnotist. Scott Adams doesn't watch movies that have violence. You know, he doesn't want to program his mind with that kind of fear. Mm-hmm. And so this is an amazing thing to think about. Like, it's like, okay, well, now that I know that, it's a little disconcerting because you're thinking, well, I had this idea that I was conscious and I was making, you know, conscious, rational choices. But in fact, on some level, I've been programmed. So, well, what if I program myself? What is it that I want? And what is the program that I want to input into my mind to get the result that I want? And we can do that. So we are very programmable. We just have to be mindful about what it is we're consuming. It's really the same as diet.
Yeah.
Right. If you want to be healthy, well, you have to be very mindful about what it is you're actually consuming. And I think mm-hmm. the same is true of the mind. And, you know, that opens up a whole other can of worms. But, you know, because the mind is unbelievably powerful. I mean, there's that study. I mean, Huberman talks about it. I forget. It's this Stanford professor, where they give two different people the same milkshake. Mm. It's a, you know, milkshake. So it's ice cream, sugar, the whole thing. And they tell one group of people that it's a, you know, it's a regular milkshake. And they tell the other group of people, this is a super healthy milkshake. It's like actually really good for you. And then they do a blood draw of both groups. And the insulin response in the group that thought it was healthy is significantly less.
Holy crap.
And the hormone that controls hunger is significantly more, meaning they thought it was healthy, so it didn't fill them up. So they're still hungry. So just the belief in what they were drinking, they both had the same thing. They had a different physiological response. And there's all kinds of studies demonstrating that idea, that concept. And so once you really get your head around that, you realize like it's all mental. Everything is just mental. How you're seeing things, it goes back to what we're saying about the language. So what I do now is if I'm on the road and I'm, you know, it's like there's nothing else to eat, so I've got to stop in at McDonald's or whatever, I tell myself that this is healthy food. You know, this is nutritious, healthy food. And I convince myself that. I hypnotize myself knowing that my body will have a different physiological response to that food if I convince myself that it's healthy. That's a real thing.
You heard it here first, everyone. David is promoting McDonald's. It's healthy. I'm curious, are we more susceptible? Are we more sponge-like in different stages of adulthood? And maybe that question isn't clear, but I'm just thinking like, we're talking childhood. I understand like we're really a sponge at that point in our life, but I don't have freaking children listening to this show. So I'm curious, like, I don't know. In the morning, are we more susceptible to shit that we're picking up on social or?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think picking up your phone first thing in the morning is not a good idea. Well, you're coming out of a theta brainwave state.
There you go. Right? Okay.
And so you're very, I mean, that's what hypnosis is. You're trying to get the person into a theta wave state. And in that place where we're kind of surrendered our rational mind, it's very easy to hypnotize somebody. So, you know, picking up the phone just out of bed, you're the most permeable. So you want to be really, really careful about what it is that you're consuming, in the morning. So like one of the things that I've started doing in the morning is, that's when I write my affirmations and I look at my, like I have this, what I call a mindset folder. And it's just, it's, you know, it's like my goals. It's like a vision board that I created online for myself. And that's what I do first thing in the morning. So get out of bed. That's the first thing I look at. I'm programming my mind, to see the things that I want to see, the things that are going to encourage me, the things that, focusing on the things that I want to create, as opposed to flipping on the phone and, you know, checking the news and seeing that everything's going to hell.
Yeah. I'm so guilty of picking up the phone. So it's just like another reminder for me to stop freaking doing that.
It's hard, man. That phone is addictive. I have the same problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to be nosy for a quick second. The bobblehead behind you. What team is that?
Ichiro.
Ichiro
Suzuko. Yeah.
Are you a Mariners fan?
No, but I was like, I was obsessed with Ichiro.
Oh my God. How can you not be? The guy was
He was so interesting. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He was just such an interesting baseball player to watch. And when he came onto the scene, I thought he was fascinating. I mean, he's obviously a great player, but just his whole aura. There's a kind of a Buddha-like quality to him. And so, I don't know, he represents that to me, kind of excellence and discipline and mastery. So I don't know. I got the Ichiro bobble. I mean, I've had that, I don't know, 15 years.
I love that. I was being nosy, but, you know, I love baseball. I you know, played baseball my entire life. And you just made me realize the way you were talking about Ichiro, I had a fascination with an Asian player who was actually on the Mets for a little bit. And the way that they carry themselves and conduct themselves on the field is so different than what we see from the players from Latin America, from the born and bred American players. The player I'm referring to is Taiyoshi Shinjo. Mm-hmm. And every time, and this is, I don't know, I'm born in 92. So this guy was probably late 90s, early 2000s. But the way that he would catch a fly ball, he would do like a little hop. And like just the way that they would carry them, it's fascinating. Like just looking from culture to culture when it comes to the game, it's crazy.
It is crazy. Yeah, the Japanese players are cool, man.
Yeah.
They got a style. And I've never been to Japan, but I just, you know, I mean, all things Japanese. There's something about that culture, the refinement, the precision, the values that they have. I mean, they create, you know, so many beautiful things. And And it's, yeah, it gets reflected in their baseball players.
So let's tie this in. We're talking about style here. What's your advice for someone to start owning their own style, right? And to add a little layer to that, it's like, how do we know what our style is versus the style that we've been conditioned to believe is ours?
You mean just style in what we wear or how we show up, just all like who we are, just style?
Who we are as people, right? Like how, I mean, mm-hmm. for example, like how I show up on this podcast is different than, you know, how you show up on yours or whatever the case is, yeah. you know, like ultimately I'm asking, how do we identify if what we're currently embodying is as our style? How do we know if it's ours or if it's what we've been programmed to believe is ours and then vice versa? How do we own that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it starts with just letting yourself know what you like, what you actually like, which is not an easy thing because we are programmed. The media is constantly telling us what we should be buying, what we should be wearing, what's cool, mm-hmm. what's not cool. And we're bombarded by that. And as you know, we talked about, we're easily persuadable and we look at other people and it's monkey see, monkey do. So that hat looks cool on that guy. I got to get that hat. And I think that's just part of human nature. But if you can separate yourself from that and really start to like, what is it that I like? Like if I let go of all of that, all that conditioning, can I actually even let myself know what I like and then start to play with it? You know, mm-hmm. like go out, get that shirt or those shoes that, you know, maybe nobody else thinks is cool, but you think are cool. And own it, you know, just own like this is what I'm into. This is what I like. And what happens, I think, is when you do own it and you're not self-conscious about it and you enjoy wearing it and it makes you feel good or whatever it is, or, you know, because it's not just about clothes. Yeah, it's just about what you do or the things that you're into. The more that you own it, the more people actually are going to think it's cool because that's ultimately what cool is. Is somebody who's an independent thinker who seems not to be concerned about what other people think, who doesn't follow the trends, who follows their own path. So, but that takes a while often to let yourself know what you like and not think of yourself as I have this weird taste or, you know, there's something off about it. Like just, you know, whether it's music or art or clothes or, you know, pastime, like my fiance's, she's into Mayan astrology and she's like, it's a whole thing. I mean, it's a whole world. Like you study the Mayan calendar and she was like into it and she was fascinated by it. And she started writing about it and posting about it. And she kept saying, oh, I don't want people to think I'm weird. I'm weird. I'm like, who cares? Like, just own it. Just own it. Like, this is what you're into. You don't know why you're into it. Like, who knows why? But it's giving you something. You're passionate about it. It gives you a lot of excitement. So just own it. And once she started just owning it, like, she just gave herself permission to enjoy it. And then more people became attracted to her and her work because of that.
I think that's what gets us caught up, right? So it's that gap that you just talked about. It's like the thinking that I'm going to be viewed as weird, the period from that to the period in which people are attracted to you because you're authentically inclined to like that thing. I think, mm-hmm. you know, is there a way to shorten that gap?
I don't think so. I think you got to go through that awkward period. I mean, that's what change is. Any kind of change is awkward at first. I mean, I think about it. I used to be an actor and, you know, when you're getting into the character, mm-hmm. it takes a minute, right? Like you just trying on the clothes and everything else. You don't just like become Richard III overnight, you know? It takes some time to walk in his shoes and mm-hmm. really feel into it. But then over time, if you keep at it, like the character begins to emerge and it kind of becomes you, or you become it and it becomes organic and integrated. And then you're not thinking about it anymore. You're just being it. And I think the same really is true. Any kind of change we want to make, at first it feels strange. It is like putting on a kind of outfit that you've never worn before. And at first it's going to feel strange, but if you just keep wearing it over time, it's going to become normal. And so, yeah, I think we do have to tolerate that awkward period where we're in the unknown. I think often with any kind of change, that's what people are resisting. They don't like that feeling of being in that liminal space, the in between, but there's really no way out of it. Like, you have to learn to exist in that place and tolerate that discomfort and trust that, like, you'll get there eventually if you just keep at it.
I want to touch on the whole, you know, stepping into the character and stepping out of the character. Maybe to be a little metaphorical here, but how do we step out of the character that society, culture, parents, family, friends, whomever built us up to be, to really connect back with who we are? Like, I guess what I'm really asking is, how do we decondition ourselves?
Mm-hmm. It's not an easy thing to do. And if I go into the psychology of it, I mean, one, in terms of, you know, evolutionary psychology and evolutionary biology, I mean, we're tribal.
Yeah.
And so on some level, we're wired to stay connected, mm-hmm. and in favor with the tribe, right? That's our highest priority, because that's the way we're going to survive. So we don't want to do things that are going to get us excluded from the tribe, which is why most people are fairly agreeable and conformist. Mm-hmm. And then on the psychological level, you know, a child is basically helpless, and they need their parents so that they can survive. So they're going to adapt themselves to fit what they perceive their parents generally, but schools as well, and friends, what they want from them, right? They want to meet their expectations, because staying in proximity and in favor is their best chance of survival. So there's something innate in us that wants to conform. Mm-hmm. And, but then we become adults and we realize that we don't actually have to do that anymore. So, but there's some other part of us that's going to resist it. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, the journey that a lot of people go on in their lives. Like, how do I uncondition myself? Well, I think the first thing you have to do is you really have to change your environment. Because it is true, you are the product of the five people you spend the most time with. You're a product of your environment. That's why you want to be very careful about the environment that you create for yourself, whether it's your room, your office, your home, your car. Like, you want to be extremely mindful, because it has an impact on you. We are not separate from it. And Benjamin Hardy's got a great book about this called Willpower Doesn't Work. And, you know, the premise of the book is, like, if you want to change, you have to change your environment. You have to build an environment and build structures and put them in place in order for you to flourish. And so he spends a lot of time describing how to do that. And of course it makes perfect sense, mm-hmm. you know? And so, you know, if you want new experiences, if you want to change, you've got to go seek out new experiences, new kinds of people, allow yourself to be influenced by them, see that there's other ways of seeing the world, see that there's other perspectives, seeing that people are thriving in all kinds of ways. And so if mm-hmm. you are somebody who grew up, maybe you didn't have a lot of money and your parents have a scarcity mindset, well, it's going to be very hard for you to get out of that unless you begin to spend time around people who have an abundance mindset, who are making money and who don't have any shame about money, who have a good relationship with money. And if you start spending more and more time around those kinds of people, well, that's, you're going to absorb that, and you're going to see the goodness of that. And it's going to rub off on you. It's going to change your perspective. And if you change your perspective, it's going to change how you're looking at reality.
How do we navigate the discomfort that comes up when we put ourselves in proximity of individuals that have different beliefs than we do? And obviously, I mean, proximity is power, right? Like, we're going to get pulled to it. So for example, on the topic of money, or like if you're surrounding yourself with five people that view money in a more healthy way, it's not a scarcity mindset, it's abundance, etc. How do we deal with the discomfort of us getting pulled into that from what we once knew?
I think you have to have leverage, and the best leverage is pain. So usually we only change when we're experiencing pain, when we're brought to our knees. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what is the saying? Like we only change when the pain of staying where we are is greater than the imagined fear of the change. And so, if you want to change, you have to create leverage. I mean, this is fundamental for everything, you know, any kind of habit change. You have to create some kind of leverage for yourself, in order, because otherwise you're not going to do it. You're going to fall back to old patterns. You're going to fall back to comfort, because staying in that unknown place, there's a lot of discomfort and there's a lot of emotions that are going to come up in that place. And when we have uncomfortable emotions, our mind, our ego tends to begin to tell us stories about, you know, why this isn't working or why we shouldn't be there, or who did you think you are, or this is never going to work out, or these people are evil, they're crazy. Mm-hmm. But those are that's just the fear speaking. So we have to, you know, we have to get really as conscious as we can. We have to have a very strong intention. And, you know, also when we change, we leave people behind. Mm-hmm. And that's also painful. I mean, we all experience that. I mean, I'm 54 and I've, you know, felt like I've lived a number of lifetimes, and I've left so many people behind, and you know, people have left me behind as well. Mm-hmm. And it's painful. And there is like a part of me that's like, did I do something wrong? Like, mm-hmm. why haven't I reached out to this person who used to be one of my closest friends back in my 20s? What, you know, we haven't spoken in 5 years. You know, am I supposed to reach out to him? And there's those thoughts of guilt. But really, it's like, well, no, that was somebody who was in my life at that time. And our paths crossed in that moment, and that was okay. And you know, I don't owe him anything, and everything's okay. So, you know, we're constantly changing, we're constantly evolving. That's the truth of life. That's the constant of life. And to let yourself know and trust that. Listen, not it's scary. Change is scary. It's, you know, never ending change, and it's we're always adapting. We're always evolving. There is no place that you get to where you just land and you've made it and everything's okay. That doesn't exist. That's not a thing. And I know that because I've had it. You know, I got everything that I thought I wanted. And it's not that things didn't change, but I was still the same internally, and mm-hmm. the world never stops turning. And so you're always going to be, you know, working, you know, on some level, right? Yeah. You always have to stay engaged in life. You have to stay present. You're always going to be challenged. You know, it's like, you know, anybody who's been in a relationship for, you know, 20, 25, 30 years, it's like, it never stops, you know, mm-hmm. They're always growing and changing, and thank God. Right. And I think that's the mindset shift that I think a lot of people, have to make. It's hard to know that when you're in your 20s, cause you're just trying to figure it out. You're trying to make it. You're trying to prove yourself in the world. But then once you do that, you realize, okay, this is never ending.
Yeah.
And I always have to be engaged with life. And in fact, that is the beauty of it.
Mm. We were talking about environments, our environments before, and I want to run this quote by you. It's not verbatim, but it goes something along the lines of, you can't heal at the scene of the crime. And you were just mentioning the importance of changing our environment. So yeah. What do you feel about that quote? Like, is that true? You can't heal at the scene of the crime?
I think that's true.
Okay.
I think that's true. I think you have to get out. If you've been in an environment where you were hurt, like if you had an abusive father or abusive mother, or not even abusive, just, you know, you had parents, you know,
yeah.
we all get screwed up in some way by our parents. And if you're a parent out there, you're going to screw up your kids because we're human. It's fine. You know, it's just part of life. And I think we do have to get away from them and from that, or whether it's a, you know, we're in relationship with somebody and it's really toxic. I think it is important to get out of it so that we can gain some perspective and feel ourselves, because most trauma that we experience happens in relationship. Like we got hurt by somebody else, whether it was directly or indirectly, whether it was abusive or they just ignored us or we weren't seen or felt or understood, whatever it is. And so it's important for us to get out of that environment in order to feel ourselves, to feel what actually happened to us, and then get perspective, I think, from another, because it's very hard. If you're in a relationship with somebody it's hard to see what's actually going on in the moment. I mean, we've all had that, right? You're with somebody and for a couple years or whatever, and maybe you fought a lot and it was, you know, uncomfortable, and then you finally break up, and a year or two later you look back and you see it with a lot of clarity. You can't see things in real time. So I think it is important to, we have to separate ourselves from the environment that we were in that caused us pain and grief.
So if the most trauma happens in relationship, where does the most healing happen?
In relationship.
Okay.
Most people heal in their personal relationships, whether it's friendships, but most often in their romantic relationships. I mean, that's where most healing occurs, I think, if you have the wherewithal and the willingness and the intention to do it. I mean, a lot of people get into relationship thinking, well, I'm going to get into relationship because I want to get my needs met.
Mm-hmm.
And quickly you find out that that's, you know, not exactly what's going to happen. I mean, you are going to get you should get your needs met in relationship. But what happens to us is that we have all these childhood needs that were not met. And then we get in relationship with the belief that, well, this person is going to meet my childhood needs, but of course they can't, right? Yeah. You're not a child anymore. And that time has come. It's and come and gone. And so that healing work is for us to do. And, you know, I think healthy relationships at some point we're in that fantasy, that Eros phase where we believe that, you know, this person on some level, we might not use this language, but they're going to save us. And then we come into the reality that that's just another person standing across from us, and they have their own issues and I have my own issues and they have their insecurities and I have mine and they have doubt about whether they're perfectly lovable and I have that too. And you have to confront that and take ownership of it and not put your happiness in their hands. Mm. And it's in that place that you can actually have real relationship. And so I think through relationship is really where most people heal. And that's why, you know, the work that I do, whether it's one-on-one, I mean, the healing comes through the relationship, through the relationship that the client has with me. I mean, the work we do together is important, but it's actually the dynamic, the relationship that is the thing. And that's why the group work, you know, my workshops is so interesting, because, you know, you come for a weekend or a week and you're going to do this workshop and you're going to get into all your emotions. And there's going to be people in the group that you are attracted to. There's going to be people in the group that annoy you. There's going to be people in the group that you're afraid of. And all of those people are proxies for people in your past, right? Yeah. They're provoking you because there's something unresolved inside you. So there's always an opportunity to do your own healing in relationship with others. And so there's no way out. Like I was somebody who, you know, isolated myself for a long time because it's like, I didn't want to deal with people because I'd been so hurt. And so I'm not going to open up. I'm not going to make myself vulnerable. I don't want to get into relationship. It's for me, relationship just equaled pain. But then I realized, like, there's no way out of this. Like, this isolation is not going to work. I need other people. I need to be in connection. And so I began to seek it out. And I made a commitment that I'm always going to live in community. And I've been doing that now for like 10 years, well, longer, really 15 years, always in some kind of community. And like, it's like any community, there's people there that you love and there's people there that drive you fucking crazy, but there's no way out of it. This is the human experience. And for those people that drive you crazy, that's an opportunity. You know, what is this for me? Why am I so agitated? Why does this person frustrate me so much? And what happens if I stop judging them and actually feel what's going on inside me?
Yeah. How do you feel about the word healing? And the reason I'm asking this is because we were talking about society, social, and things of that nature earlier. But the word healing, like, how do you feel about that word?
I think there's a lot. You know, you go on Instagram and if you follow the therapists and the coaches and the breath workers, there's all kinds of insanity going on. And some people are more qualified to talk about it than others. But I think it's a net positive because we all need to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's real. And I think most of us have had an experience of healing.
Yeah.
And what is healing? Well, from my perspective, it's allowing ourselves to feel the pain of what happened to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like most of us distract ourselves from our pain. We don't want to feel it. We feel shame about it. We numb it. We avoid it. We work it away. We fuck it away. We smoke it away. Like we don't want to deal with it. And so I think healing is just simply that, allowing yourself to sit and be with and feel and express our pain. And I think the body has a natural mechanism that allows us to move that energy, that feeling out of us, and we can come back to homeostasis. So I think healing is a very natural, organic process. It's just, we just have to allow ourselves to do it. I mean, if you get a cut on your finger, it heals itself.
Right.
So, and I think we actually are wired to heal ourselves. I mean, if you look at, there's all kinds of clips, whether it's zebras or gazelles, they're being chased by a lion and they get away. And then once they're safe, they lay down and shake.
Mm.
They just shake for 10 or 15 minutes, literally shaking it off. And then they get up and then they just go back to eating the grass or whatever it is they're doing. They're not looking around constantly for the lion to come, right? And so I think we have that natural mechanism in our bodies. Like we can actually, I mean, the phrase shake it off. I mean, it's interesting that we say that, just shake it off.
Mm.
And there's a lot of work to support that. The work of bioenergetics, Alexander Lowen, and then the work of David Berselli called tension or trauma release exercises, TRE. Mm. And it's essentially just that. It's breath work is essentially that. You're allowing yourself to just, you know, go inside and let your body do its thing. Give it permission. You know, you have to let go of control. That's the scary part. But when you do, you can heal yourself. You don't have to necessarily go to a therapist and talk about your problems. I mean, you can, and that can be useful, but I think there's ways of, I think going to the gym is healing. I think going to yoga, sure, is healing. I think contact, touch is healing. You know, what somebody slips on the ice, you know, and breaks their ankle or something and you know, mm-hmm, on a sidewalk. Well, what happens? Like a group of people will kind of gather around and create a container for that person. And if they're really in pain, somebody will like hold their hand and somebody will have their hand on their back. Like we all just intuitively do this. I saw a picture of a college basketball team where a guy had really had a serious injury. He, you know, snapped his ankle in half and he was just wailing in pain. And the whole team came around him and they were like holding him. Mm-hmm. There's no other environment where these guys would hold each other, you know,
sure.
They would hold hands or touch each other, but they all just something else took over. And I think that's because intuitively we know that, that touch actually has a kind of, emotional, healing power. And it's actually the best, one of the best things that we can do for our trauma.
I love that. I love that. What's a question you wish more people would ask you and how would you answer it?
Nothing's really coming to mind.
I don't mean to throw a curveball. I know you're not each year.
Yeah, no, it's okay. It's a good, it's not a bad, it's a good question. I just, what people ask me all kinds of,
I'm sure.
Question. Well, I'll give you an answer. You know, most people have discovered me recently anyway, from, you know, the interview that I did with Andrew Tate. And then I did one with Blair White and Candy Ken. And I just did one with Danny Morrell. And these are interviews, but they're kind of like therapy mm-hmm. sessions almost. And, you know, what am I doing? I'm doing the interviews. I'm creating the content that I want to see.
Yeah.
And I love talking about ideas and concepts because they're really interesting. But what I'm most interested, and obviously I have a bias because, you know, this is the world that I live in, is really talking about people's personal stuff, mm-hmm. you know, like the things that happen to them and how that shaped them. And they're not always easy things to talk about because they take us to our edge. And even for me, even though I've talked about this stuff a lot, it's still scary to talk about because also you're entering into the unknown. I mean, that was the interesting thing about the Tate interview is there were moments where I got him into the unknown. Yeah. Like he's totally in control of himself almost all the time. And so I think what was so interesting about that interview is like, he wasn't always in control. Mm. And what was interesting for me is I could tell how much he enjoyed it. Mm. Like he enjoyed that experience of not knowing where things are going, not having the questions be idea and concept oriented. Like it forced him to think. And so I guess that's what I'm most interested in. And I think that's where things are going. I think that's what people want now more than ever, is to really like what's going on inside. Like, what are your fears? What are your insecurities? Yeah. What are you scared of? What's been painful for you? Mm-hmm. What are you longing for? You know, where do you not love yourself? What's your struggle? Mm-hmm. I mean, I mean, you know, I'm saying that I'm like, I don't want you to ask me those questions because they're uncomfortable questions. But in some sense, it's like, you know, I'm okay talking about ideas and concepts. Like I'm a reasonably intelligent person, but there's people that are so much better at that than I am, like explaining these things. And I'm like, well, but that thing is what I think I'm actually really good at. Like I'm really good at having deep conversations and about emotions and understanding, you know, people on that level. Obviously, because I've spent, you know, the last 15, 20 years focused exclusively on that.
Sure. And that leads me to ask you this question, right? Like, what would be your advice, maybe for a creator that's tuned into this? And, you know, I'm asking this very selfishly, by the way. It's like, if I came at you and I started asking you those deep questions without a lick of rapport, you know, there would probably be like a level of, I don't know, maybe it is discomfort or whatever the word may be.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be your advice? Like, how do you do it to approach the Tates and the Dannys and whomever else with those deeper conversations? Or is it just natural for you because it's been your line of work?
Well, it's become natural, but it was a skill that I had to learn and develop. And you're right. You have to develop rapport. You have to develop trust. And if you watch the Tate interview, you'll notice what I'm doing early on is it's called unconditional positive regard, which is I'm acknowledging his perspective, right?
Okay.
Like I'm reflecting back to him that what he is saying makes sense.
Yeah.
So what that does, and I agree, I'm not doing it artificially. It's like, I'm not manipulating him. I'm actually in agreement. Yep. That makes sense. I can see how you would see it that way. Right. Like I'm, because all I'm trying to do is understand how he thinks.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not judging anything. I mean, that if you want to be a really good interviewer, and I don't mean you, I just mean one, cause you are a very good interviewer. And I feel this coming off you, you have a very, you're non-judgmental, right? Mm-hmm. You're just curious. And that's really the key skill. And when people feel like they're being asked questions and they're not being judged in any way, and that the person is just genuinely curious, they're much more willing to open up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is a whole skill to, you know, once you create that trust and you create that rapport, then you can gently guide them into more, I don't know, vulnerable or complex areas and allow yourself to challenge them. Because if you do that without creating that rapport, it is a little bit of an invasion and they're going to shut down. I mean, like, you know, the context of the interview with Tate was explicit, right? Yeah. I mean, I said it at the outset, I'm going to try to reveal things to you that you don't know about yourself. So that's, that's the frame. That's now the game that we are playing. And with Blair White, it was different because she was explicit. Like I want to have a session. I'm up for anything. And I was like, okay, you know, so we had set the boundaries of that at the beginning. And then it's really just attuning to the person, like staying present with them, because, you know, what I've learned, you know, from all the years that I've been doing this work is what are most people actually longing? What are children longing for? They're longing for their parent to be present with them, just there, like paying attention to them, listening to them, attuning to them. And so when you give a person that, like if you really are present with them, it feels so good to them. And they're going to immediately trust that and open up. So that's the, and listen, that I think is like one of the great meta skills that you can have, because if you can learn to be present with other people, because I don't care what business you're in, you're doing business with other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Tony Robbins and all kinds of people talk about this with, you know, in terms of NLP and pacing and leading and all of that. And matching your breath. And I don't think about it in the technical term. I think about it more in the emotional term, right? But if you're just present and attuned and demonstrating curiosity for another person and they really feel that you're with them.
Yeah.
Well, then you have connection. And once there's connection, then things are going to happen.
Absolutely. David, I've appreciated this tremendously. I know I need to let you go in a couple minutes. So two last questions. Number one is, what do you have going on that we should let people know about right now? What should we throw in the show notes of this episode? I know you were talking about the workshops and whatnot, but anything specific that you want to share?
Yeah, I do. I just launched this website. Well, it's a program. I don't know what it is yet, but it's called School for Kings. Schoolforkings.com. And I'm doing an 8-week program starting April 11th. It'll be online, and I opened a Substack, and so I've been writing all kinds of things in support of it. And so it's really geared towards men who don't want to go to therapy, because most men don't want to go to therapy, and I understand that. there's a lot of good reasons not to go to therapy. And I don't necessarily think therapy is right for everyone, but I think every person knows that they, probably could understand, learn to understand themselves emotionally, in a better way, that there's really power in knowing themselves. And that I think most of us occasionally our emotions get the best of them. So I'm really gearing it towards that kind of man, you know, who's not going to go to therapy, but who's wants to kind of know more about themselves and how their emotions work without it being, I don't know what the word is, but you know,
I get what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the thing that I just launched that I'm really excited about. And, I think it's awesome. Going to be an amazing program. Yeah, I'm stoked because I love working with men, and obviously men are in crisis right now. I think that's a kind of a trope, but I think it's true.
Yeah,
not all men, and I think a lot of men have it together. But there's the times are changing, and men's role in the culture is changing, and I think there's a lot of confusion, and I think there's a lot of pain and a lot of shame that men have. And, I'm hoping to be one of the places that people can go to be in support of men and their journey.
I love that. I'm going to make sure that is in the show notes of this episode, as well as socials, websites, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
But one last question for you. I know that I need to let you go in a minute here, and I hate going over time. One last question.
Okay.
You live to whatever year you want to live to. You impact as many men with your work. You interview these people, whatever it is that you want to do as you evolve. But you could only be remembered for one piece of advice. It's one of those one thing questions. What's the one piece of advice you want to be remembered for?
It's all a game. Play. That's how I think about it. This is not real, man. This is all a dream, right? Like you don't have to take it so seriously. Hold it lightly. We're all going to die. Nobody cares about you. Nobody's going to care about you. Nobody's going to know that you existed 100 years from now. Don't take yourself so seriously. And so just approach life like that. Like just play the game, have fun with it, but get involved. Like when I say play, I mean play. Like, if you're going to go play baseball, it's like you have the most fun when you play hard and play to win, but you're not taking it too seriously, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're kind of holding it lightly. I mean, I think, I've been watching all these Larry Bird videos because he was like, my hero growing up, and the thing that I see about Larry Bird, and I think Michael Jordan had this to a degree, they had a lot of fun when they were playing. Gretzky too, Ichiro, you saw the joy. And I think about that when I watch Tom Hanks act, because I think he's incredible. He looks like he's having so much fun. And so that would really be my advice. Just play.
I love that, David. Thank you so much for this opportunity. This has been incredible.
Appreciate it, Matt. Good to talk to you, man.